Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. Day, September 30th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. We have a special guest on our show tonight. But first, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you? Glad you're with us and glad everybody's with us tonight. We do have a special guest tonight. But before we introduce him and bring him on to the show, I want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show. So you can let us know what's on your mind as far as veteran issues. Or you can even talk to our guest tonight. He's going to be talking about the water contamination at Camp Lejeune. Our toll-free call-in number covering the entire United States is 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. So, and as I always say, you know, at this part when we first start, you know, pick up the phone and call us. You know, veterans, this is your show. It's the Veterans News Hour. You know, David and I try to provide an opportunity for veterans to share their beef with the VA. Tell everybody what's going on in your own situation. And so this is a forum to do that. And you can even speak to our guest tonight, who, by the way, is Mike Partain. And tonight he's going to discuss, as he's done previously, the toxic water contamination at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, which occurred between 1953 and 1987. So Mike Partain is a co-founder and public spokesman for an organization called Few, the Proud, the Forgotten. From 1953 until 1987, the base water supply for Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, was highly contaminated with industrial chemicals. For the past decade, he has served as a community representative to the estimated 1 million sailors, Marines, and their families potentially affected by the Camp Lejeune contamination. He has testified before Congress, and he was invited as a special guest to the White House in 2012 for the signing of the Denny Ensminger Act into law. Much of his group's fight for justice was chronicled in the award-winning documentary Semper Fi, Always Faithful. So without further ado, let's welcome Mike to the show. How are you tonight, Mike?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good, good, brother. You know, you have been on the show before, and we've talked about the Camp Lejeune issues, and we're going to get into some more recent stuff. But for some of our guests who may not be familiar with you or familiar with how you got involved with the Camp Lejeune water contamination, give us a brief background of your involvement.
Well, before we do that, Rick, I had somebody ask a question on the website. You'd posted up a link. Part of the below it says this content is not available right now, but there's a link, bbsradio.com, the Veteran News Hour. Is that where someone would click to listen to the show?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure, because like I said, that one part appeared below on the Facebook page, the Camp Lejeune Toxic Water Survivors page that we have.
Okay.
To answer your question, I'm a dependent. My grandfather was a Marine officer, World War II, and my father was also a Marine officer. He was born in Paris Island, and I had the dubious honor of being born aboard Camp Lejeune. I was briefly in the Navy, but actually disqualified from service due to a skin problem that I was born with from Camp Lejeune. Anyways, I was born aboard the base, conceived and born, 1968. And at the ripe age of 39, out of the blue, I was diagnosed with male breast cancer, which is an extremely rare disease, especially in men who do not drink, do not do drugs, do not have the BRCA1 or 2 breast cancer mutations, and especially for a man who's under the age of 70. Which those are all the risk groups for the disease, and I don't fall in any of them. Over the past 12 years since my diagnosis, I've located about 110-plus men. I forgot the exact count but 110 men that share the unique commonality of male breast cancer and exposure to the contaminated water, drinking water aboard the base. The drinking water, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we have the dates 1953 to 1987, but there's also another issue that we're currently working on, which we're going to talk about tonight, too, as part of the CAP meeting that took place in Washington a couple of weeks ago, in the form of what's called vapor intrusion. You know, our exposures, my exposure was derived by drinking the water, or in my case, my mom mixing my formula with water, the water she drank while she was pregnant with me, plus the water I was bathed in, and everything else that you do with water, all that water was contaminated. the other issue is called vapor intrusion, which these contamination plumes, which exist on the base, these are what they call volatile organic compounds. And what they do is they volatilize at a lower temperature than like water would. So what happens is they permeate through the soil. If you have a building that has cracks in the slab or open foundation for plumbing, that gas will actually accumulate in the building, kind of like radon gas here in Florida. That's where I'm from. And it can be a toxic hazard. After the contamination was shut down in the drinking water, this vapor intrusion issue actually extended all the way up to the early 2000s. And we were turned on to it mainly because of veterans getting sick with some of the same cancers that we were seeing with the drinking water contamination, but there was no known source. And, you know, since then we have found that, like, for example, Building 1101 in the 1990s was used as a fleet data processing center where they had an office with staff inside, and underneath that building was a huge gas plume, about 1.5 million gallons of fuel that was in the aquifer, and all that, all the fumes were rising up into the building, and consequently, those people got sick. But that, I mean, that's another long story. But you know, like I said, my involvement began in 2007 after I was diagnosed with male breast cancer, and continues to this day, some 12 years later.
Well, you've been doing some great work there, you and Jerry. Now, tell us a little bit about, I know you just came back from D.C. and you were at the CAP meeting. CAP stands for Community Assistance Panel. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the CAP organization and then get into what happened on, I think it was September 13th up in D.C.
Yes. Now, the Community Assistance Panel, it is basically our only source to express our grievances. Well, and I'll take that back. It's our only source to interact with the government. It's not an avenue to express our grievances, but I know when the community meetings happen, that's usually what transpires. But when you have a Superfund site that's like Camp Lejeune, and what I mean by Superfund site, when the EPA comes in and designates a pollution site as what they call a national priorities list, or under CERCLA, which is the the congressional the legislation that designates what to do with toxic cleanups. One component of that is a health study, and the CDC handles that part of it mainly through what's called the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. It is that agency works as part of the CDC, and their job is to look at toxic exposures and evaluate them to whether or not there's a health risk or a health hazard for that. And every Superfund site goes through this process. Their first document that comes out is called a public health assessment. Now, in the case of Camp Lejeune in 2005, as the scientists were conducting their initial studies into the toxic water at Camp Lejeune, they formed a community assistance panel known as a CAP, made up of members of the community. And this CAP is interacted with ATSDR. We don't have an official voice, meaning we can't tell ATS Air what to do or you know, provide guidance and things like that. We're there as an advisory role. For example, if we, you know, if the community was to have knowledge of toxic waste dumps or potential exposures or just things that the scientists don't have access to, we can assist them with that. And that's what we've done over the past 14 years as the CAP. I joined the CAP in 2007, and Jerry Insminger has been a member of the CAP since its inception in 2005. Now, during the course of these past 14 years, the CAP has worked very closely with ATS there, the scientists there. And at one point, the Marine Corps had representatives there, but as we started to discover documents and indications that the Marine Corps was not, and when I say the Marine Corps and the Department of the Navy, were not being as truthful as they said they were, mainly that they were hiding the true extent of the fuel problem or the fuel losses on the base that got into the aquifer. They withdrew from the meetings and used an excuse kind of along the lines that they felt that their presence there was interfering with the progress of ATSDR in the community, which is a bunch of hogwash. So, you know, we meet every four months. Primarily, it's been in Atlanta, Georgia. But over the past couple of years, we have asked the CDC to extend these meetings to at least one meeting outside of Atlanta to the country, because one of the unique things about Camp Lejeune is that our toxic site, while it's located in Jacksonville, North Carolina, we're not from Jacksonville, North Carolina. My parents were there for about two and a half years. But they were about a year and a half to almost 2 years. And then they left the base after I was born and my dad was deployed to Vietnam. We never went back. And I'm not, even though my birth certificate says I'm from Camp Lejeune, that's not my hometown. My hometown's Winter Haven, Florida. That's where I grew up, and that's where, you know, that's home for me. My parents still live there. So we've asked the ATSDR to hold meetings at different parts of the country. We've done one in Tampa, Florida. We've done one up in Pittsburgh. We've done one outside of Atlanta, away from the CDC facility, because if you've never been there, the CDC facility can be a little bit of intimidating. You have to pass a armed security check. It's all locked down, and you have to register in advance. It can be very discouraging for the public to attend. And then the last one we had was September 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C.
One of the things you and I talked about before you came on the show, and you kind of touched upon it, was I asked you the question, if any of our politicians from this, you know, the House, Senate, bothered to show up for the meeting either on the 13th or the 14th, and you said that no, there were no politicians there, and you said something that's kind of interesting, and that was that that in your dealing with other politicians, they say to you, "Well, it's a North Carolina issue." That's not true. It's not a North Carolina issue.
No, I mean it is in a sense that it took place in North Carolina. But when you look at the Marine Corps' registry, which they have on their website, and you click on the different states, you know, like, for example, I think there's 24,000 people registered with the Marine Corps. And this registry, by the way, is not a health registry. It's an informational registry where you get mailings from the Marine Corps. Florida's second with about 23,000. And the different states, you know, range on down to several thousand throughout the country. But the thing is, you know, in the past, when we've dealt with different political offices, most of them want to defer to North Carolina, meaning that the senators, in this case, would be Senator Tillis and Senator Burr, who, by the way, Senator Tillis did have staff at the meeting on Friday in Washington. I believe he was the only, I think Burr may have had somebody as well, but they were the only offices there, which is disappointing, especially considering that we specifically held the meeting in Washington to get, you know, public there and also to invite members of Congress to come in and see what was going on with the issue. More often than not, what ends up happening is when a constituent, say, from Georgia or Texas comes to their to the congressman or the senator, they listen and they hear, but they don't really do much. And they allow North Carolina to take the lead, meaning that those respective congressional offices come up with the legislation and then they sponsor the legislation, which isn't doing us a service. I mean, it's like I've said to some of the members of the Florida delegation that I spoke to in the past, is, hey, you've got 23,000 people here, and, you know, we need to do something more than just follow what North Carolina is doing. For example, the 2012 health care law, which became known as the Janie Ensminger law, was sponsored by a North Carolina congressman. And then once it made it as an official bill, then the Senate offices in Florida and my congressional member became co-sponsors of the bill. It'd be nice to see Washington get more involved and more back towards representing their constituents than a region or a particular political party or not. I mean, if you got constituents that are affected, then you have a dog in the fight. You need to do something about it. And that's been one of the more frustrating points about Camp Lejeune.
Now, another very frustrating issue regarding Camp Lejeune is the SME issues, which, you know, we've discussed this for quite some, for a while now, you and I, both on the show and privately over a cup of coffee. And it seems like, one, it's not getting any better, and possibly it's getting worse. So if you, you know, give our listeners a little bit of understanding about the whole SME and the problems we have there.
Yeah, I mean, the SME issue continues to be problematic. And what SME stands for is a subject matter expert. So here's what happens in a nutshell. So you come to the VA, you were stationed at Camp Lejeune, and you present a claim for, say, thyroid cancer to the VA that you believe is related to your exposures at Camp Lejeune. So the VA begins collecting all the information. They get your medical records, and they get your nexus letter from your doctor, where your doctor says, hey, look, there's no family history of this. There's no reasons why Rick should have thyroid cancer, other than the fact that he was exposed to solvents at Camp Lejeune. And there's no radiation exposure, which is a common cause for thyroid cancer and stuff. So you present your information to the VA. The VA takes this and they give it to a doctor. And on paper, it seems to be something that is, okay, that's fair. We're going to give it to a doctor and have a doctor look at it. And that's where things start to derail. Mainly, the VA controls the process, meaning the VA writes the directions to the doctor, how they're supposed to review the file. The VA provides training to the doctors on how they're supposed to handle, you know, these files. And ultimately, the doctor's recommendations, while they're not binding to the VA, they're shaped and created by the VA. So when these doctors provide the recommendations, the decision, and I forgot the name for the I'm sorry, I'm having a stutter tonight. Decision rating officer.
Decision review officer.
For it?
Decision review officer. DRO.
Yes. I couldn't remember the acronym for it. The DRO. He makes his decision. And the VA has said many times that, oh, those SMEs do not make decisions. But when a DRO gets a file from an SME that says, well, this veteran was overweight, he used to smoke, or whatever reasons they say on here, and that is our opinion that the veteran's thyroid cancer is least likely than not related to his exposures at Camp Lejeune, you can't help but fall into what they're saying. And another problem is that these, in the past, and this is one of the changes that is coming out now, in the past, up until about, I think, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, these doctors were hired by the VA. And when we started digging into these doctors' past, we didn't know who their names are. We would find them by going into the VA files or having veterans turn over their complete files, and we'd find their names in there. Like for one example, the actual coordinator of the program for a while, I don't know if he's still or not, was stripped of his medical license in the 1990s for alcoholism and molesting his own two children, and then reinstated and hired by the VA, and he was the one coordinating this. We had another doctor up in up north that ran a private practice providing consulting to defend both industry and the government for exposures exposures to employees to toxic substances. So if a worker filed a workman comp claim for exposure to TCE, this SME was providing defenses to industry and government against the worker. But yet she was going through and reviewing claims by veterans for their exposures at Camp Lejeune for the same chemical. And, or, you know, not necessarily the same chemical, but it providing exposure, doing reviews for chemical exposures. To me, that's a conflict of interest. Now, the new permit, we actually met with, he was acting secretary at the time, Wilkie, up in Washington. Jerry and I traveled up there in 2018 and presented several cases. One where a doctor quoted cut and pasted parts of Wikipedia into his decision. So here you have a medically trained doctor using Wikipedia as a source to deny a veteran's claim, and so forth. And we asked the VA secretary to look into this, and they didn't do anything about it. There was supposed to be an inquiry into it, and it basically panned out to pretty much nothing. And part of that is because what they've done with the SME is rather than have these employees, these doctors be employees of the VA, they've now outsourced it to private companies, which creates even more of an issue to me. So you've got companies that the VA is contracting with, and there's four of them, and providing services for the VA to rate all these claims and decide all these claims. Once again, it's a master-slave relationship in the sense that these companies are contracted to the VA, and they're providing a service for the VA and being paid by the VA. Where are these companies' loyalties at? Are they really with the veteran, or are they with the paycheck that they're getting for doing these reviews?
You know, Mike,
and this is problematic.
I get this like every day now when veterans come into my office and they tell me that they're going over to so-and-so's office in Ocala or Orlando or Tampa for an examination and it's being subcontracted out. And it's amazing how many of them look at me and they think, well, you know, this is really good, isn't it? You know, and I keep telling them, well, we need to get our own independent medical examiner, IME. After you get your exam from the VA, we're going to send you to somebody else. And they look at me and they go, well, is that necessary? And I said, well, think about it this way. Who's paying these people who are doing the subcontracting for the VA? Who's paying them? The VA's paying them. In order for them to continue to get this work, do you think they're going to make decisions on behalf of the veterans that's going to allow the veteran to get a higher rate of compensation than the VA wants to give out? I don't think so. And, yeah. it's an ongoing process and problem that, you know, has been, you know, I guess the last couple of years I've been seeing it, and it's been getting more and more this way, and it's not good. It's really not good at all for the
Well, there's no objectivity in the process. And like I said, it's a master-slave relationship.
And it's all about the money.
You have to question the motives, and the motives in this case are money.
Right. Now, we talked earlier also about this the whole idea of the 0% rating. You know, the VA turns around, and in the Camp Lejeune situations and in other cases, but we're talking about Camp Lejeune water contamination tonight. The VA will dole out a service, say, yes, you're service connected, and then give them a 0% rating.
Yes.
And, ignoring the residuals of a particular disease or ailment, I know you were talking about some kidney. We were talking about a veteran in his kidney. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's much more than just Camp Lejeune. You mentioned that this is, you know, mainly about Camp Lejeune, but what the listener has to realize and understand, this SME issue, this SME program that was implemented by the VA was tested out with Camp Lejeune. They've used SMEs before, but not like this, not like they're doing now. So that means future toxic exposures or future benefits, you know, if you're hurt or injured during your course of service, you may be facing an SME in the future. And they may decide, well, you had one too many cheeseburgers in your lifetime, and that's why you're sick, and not the fact that you're exposed by Camp Lejeune or by toxic water or toxic air, like in the case of, you know, the Gulf War syndrome and things like that. And I used the cheeseburger because that was actually said by a VA official that helped create this SME program back in 2000. I think it was 2013-14. I have to find it in the CAP transcripts. Her name was Dr. Terry Walters. She actually said that in the meeting. And by the way, these CAP transcripts that I mentioned before for the community assistance panel, when we have our meetings, there's a court recorder there that records every word that is said by the VA, by the ATSDR, by the Marine Corps when they were there, and by the members of the community like myself. And go through and read them. They're very telling. Unfortunately, in our modern society, people don't take the time to read things or do research or get to the bottom of stuff. But if you go through the transcripts, they're very telling, including what we're talking about right now. And I've brought this up several years. I think for the past 3-4 years, I've been bringing this up almost every CAP meeting. Everything that has been Camp Lejeune when it comes to the VA has been a fight. Before we had the 2012 healthcare law, they were, you know, basically turning people away. I think we had very few awards. Actually, at one point, we actually had awards from the VA going around 25-26%. Once the service connections were established, there's 8 presumptive service connections for Camp Lejeune that were passed in March 2017. It acts just like with Agent Orange. If you have this condition like leukemia, you were aboard Camp Lejeune 30-plus days, then you're presumed to be service-connected for your illness. Once we got that, okay, those people came across, but the people who did not have one of those 8 conditions, like, for example, male breast cancer is on the health care law, but is not one of the 8 presumed service connections. Thyroid cancer, we see lots of that at Camp Lejeune. That's not one of the, it's not on the health care law, nor is it on the presumptive service connection. Those veterans have to go through the SME process. Even the veterans who have kidney cancer, bladder cancer, leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, lung cancer, Parkinson's disease, they're still subject, you know, once they have their presumptive service connection, they're still subject to a rating. And this is a problem that we're seeing. And like I said, every step of the way the VA has fought us. They fought us for health care. Then when they got the health care, they fought us for the presumptive service connections. Then we started getting them. Now they're fighting us or continuing to fight us on the ratings. We had a veteran stand up at our meeting in Washington, 2 weeks ago, and informed us that, oh, I am a veteran of Camp Lejeune. I have my service connection, but I was rated at 0%, meaning that there's no disability, there's no compensation for anything. But if he, God forbid, got cancer again, they would treat him. If he died from kidney cancer, then they would provide for death benefits and burial and his spouse's survival, the DIC. Now, this veteran, and here's the thing that enrages me when I sit down and think about it, he underwent surgery. And he pulled, and it was funny because I said, do you have a scar? And he goes, yeah, I do. And I said, well, that's significant because scars can, you know, that's damage that's been done. And he goes, yeah, I have a big scar. And he pulled his shirt up, and I laughed, and I said, well, I've got a bigger scar because half my chest's missing. But he had an incision cut through his belly where they went in to pull 20% of his kidney out, so they amputated part of his kidney. And they rated, the VA rated him 0%, which for the life of me, I can't understand, because as a cancer survivor, when you go through cancer, you know, in a good situation, you get surgery and nothing else happens. Kind of like this veteran here. He got surgery. They got the kidney, the damaged kidney out. They got the cancer out of his body. He didn't have to undergo any radiation or any chemotherapy like I did. But he's missing 20% of his kidney. How the VA came up with 0%, for the life of me, I can't understand. And, you know, I work in insurance as an adjuster. And as an adjuster, I'm licensed and tasked by the state of Florida to adjust claims based on the policy, and I'm working for both the insurance company and the policyholder in the sense that I have to look out for both interests. I can't go outside the policy. I can't favor the insurance company, and I can't favor the policyholder either. I have to go by the terms of the policy. If I do something like that, like if I deny a claim knowing that I could pay it, it's called bad faith. And the insurance company, you know, if I did it as an adjuster, I can get in trouble for it. So can my employer. How can the VA, and this is maybe you can answer me a question here, how can the VA look at somebody who's undergone surgery, has a prominent scar that's, you know, he's compromised his abdominal wall, so may be subject to hernia in the future and things like that, plus he's missing 20% of his kidney, how can they see in good faith that he has a 0% disability rating?
So what I've found over the years, and David, you can chime in on this too, is that you know, the VA will come back and they'll say to a veteran, okay, well, your cancer is now cured and it's not, quote unquote, active any longer. Therefore, we are reducing your condition from 100% down to 0% or 20%. And that's what a whoever's handling the file, you know, initially does. So now the ball's in the veterans court to rebut that, to fight that. So if the veteran does that and he hires a DAV, he hires a lawyer, the person who now has the case should say, wait a second, what the VA is now overlooking are the residuals from that cancer, you know, and you know, for instance, in prostate cancer, the residuals might be peeing, you know, urination. He might be peeing now 5 times a day, 7 times a day, 3 times at night. Well, these are all part of the within the diagnostic code that can then elevate a 0% non-compensable rating back up to maybe a 30, 40, or even a 60% rating. But the problem there is the veteran has to take it upon him or herself to take the action to fight the VA. And, you know, you just mentioned bad faith. There's so much bad faith in the VA that it's ridiculous. So, you know, fortunately, you know, in the line of work that you do, Mike, that you are looking at both sides and you're trying to protect both sides. And that's what you should be doing. And that's what the VA should be doing. But they don't do that. And they overlook the residual impact of the ailment, the cancer. So that's really kind of what, and I deal with that a lot. I get that a lot, especially dealing with prostate cancer. I see it quite a bit. Renal cancer is another one. You see it quite a bit. So, you know, again, it's up to the VA should, on their own motion, on their own handling of the file, say, okay, Mr. Smith, you know, we're going to reduce you from 100 down to 0 or 20. But wait, let's talk to you about what are your residual, what are your symptoms. Now, maybe that's going to get you back to 30 or 40 or even 60, but they don't do that. And that's the problem. And unfortunately, too many veterans, and veterans, if you're listening tonight, you got to fight them. You can't just let the VA roll over when the VA says you're better now and the cancer is gone, so therefore it's not active, therefore we're going to reduce you. You got to fight them because you do have a remedy, but you unfortunately have to initiate seeking that remedy. So that's what goes on there. David, what do you think?
Well, I agree. Those are all excellent points, and I think, as you said, Rick, It's unfortunate that the VA doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which is to assist veterans, tell veterans what is needed to document these residual or leftover effects from the cancer. But that's where something that we've done in representing veterans is that's what we automatically do, which is we'll have the veteran, we'll work with the veteran to write out a very detailed statement about what are the leftover effects. Once the VA says or the doctors say that the cancer has been cured, it's not active, but are there any leftover effects, whether it's the scarring, but whether it's diminished kidney functioning, whether it's other things, other secondary. And the VA is particularly not good at helping veterans identify what could be secondary disabilities. And sometimes those are psychological, like depression, anxiety, but it really is important for the veterans and their representatives to be aggressive and kind of proactive, because if they have cancer, they should know that that once the treatment is over, if they're fortunate and the cancer is defeated, they need to realize that the VA is going to be looking at that issue. They shouldn't be surprised that it happens. It's part of their regulations that they will look to see if what the residuals are and reduce it. But in any event, I think it's just important for veterans to recognize that, not to be surprised, and be prepared to put their own case forward, because the VA is not going to be very helpful. And I think with the passage of the so-called Appeals Modernization Act, which we know from this past February is now fully implemented, the VA's duty to assist is minimal. And it's, to me, Rick, you offer your thoughts, but to me it seems like things have been turned upside down, that now the burden is passed much more to the veteran and the veteran's advocate.
Absolutely. And again, that's, I take calls every single day, probably 10 times a day from veterans, and they tell me about how they initiated claim 5-6 years ago, and then they got denied, and they filed again, and they got denied again, and they just kind of gave up. And now their friend says, no, give Hurley a call and talk to him about the case. And that frustration that these veterans experience is just incredible. Mike, I saw a tape of one of the meetings. I don't know if it was the 13th or the 14th, and there were some pretty heated people at those meetings, showing their own frustration with what's going on.
Yes,
and you were right in the thick of it.
Yeah, when we have the public meetings like the one we had in Washington, we had about 100 and something people in the audience. Probably between 100 and 120 would be my guess. And these people are sick, and they have some life-changing illnesses. They have life-changing health conditions that are catastrophic. I mean, I'm fortunate in myself that, yeah, while I had breast cancer and I had chemotherapy, I don't need a breast to survive, but I do need kidneys. Having a bladder is pretty important, too. And then, of course, the immune system with leukemia is another issue. And it's nice, it's good to have the community out and involved, but, and this is something that Congress is going to have to do, but we have to give, there's been no, I'm trying to put it into words what I'm experiencing, because this is not the first time we've had one of these meetings. There's no place for these people to go to address the grievances. And what I mean by that is the Marine Corps doesn't want to talk to us. I mean, Jerry's been involved in this issue for over 20 years. I've been involved for 12. At no time has Headquarters Marine Corps reached out to either Jerry, myself, or anyone in our community and said, hey, we would like to sit down and talk to you about what happened. Let's do it privately, have a meeting or anything. Nothing like that's ever occurred at Camp Lejeune. There's been no opportunity for the community to stand up and really, say, hey, this is how we feel, and And the other big part of it is, like I mentioned earlier, we're scattered all over the country. So I can meet people here in Florida, and I have, but for the most part, when the families left the base or the servicemen and women, you know, left their station and went home and what have you, they're isolated from what happened. So, it's, you know, it's not like Love Canal where Johnny is sick on Maple Street and Mary Sue on Elm Street is sick over here, and the family start talking and they figure out that something's wrong. That didn't happen to Lejeune until now. And we see a lot of this rage coming out in the public meetings because people, when we have them, are coming together for the first time, and they're seeing that what happened to them was not unique. And this brings something else to mind that I want to talk about tonight. A lot of these issues, Agent Orange, the nuclear vets for the nuclear testing back in the 1950s and 60s, the Gulf War veterans, the burn pit, they all have illness registries with the VA. Camp Lejeune is the only toxic contamination issue that does not have a health registry. Why is that? I've asked, I know I've asked, and we've asked as the CAP members, why the VA will not start collecting this data, which is critical, because when you think about it, you know, there's male breast cancer, for example, was not being looked at as a possible outcome of exposure until I appeared and started talking about it and then found other men. Well, the VA is a source for this because these veterans are going to the VA, they're going to the hospitals, and they're saying, I'm sick and I was at Camp Lejeune. If they've got skin rashes, if they've got thyroid cancer, esophageal cancer, if they've got immune disorders, those need to be recorded by the VA in an illness registry, not only to help them do their job, but also for science to start looking at what's going on. Okay, what do these chemicals do? What other illnesses that are coming out? And here's a case in point on this. During the CAP meeting on Friday the 13th of all things, the ATSDR brought out the CAP members, two of our CAP scientists that are on the panel that help the community, Dr. Cantor and Dr. Blossom, brought out a presentation of studies that were done in China with workers who were exposed to TCE, which is trichloroethylene. And these workers developed skin rashes and a dermatitis. And what was, I mean, I looked at it and it really struck me because that when I was born, I was covered in skin rashes. And I've had problems even till today. If I get around things with TC in it, I will start to break out in a rash, like a reaction. And I hear time and time again veterans who have similar problems with skin rashes. But yet, no one has looked at skin rashes. And if a health registry had been created for Camp Lejeune, I guarantee you, that would prompt some type of scientific inquiry. Why are so many people reporting skin rashes? Let's study that. Let's get together. I mean, that's what happened with male breast cancer. Enough cases were identified that the scientists actually went and did a small study on the veterans for Camp Lejeune and found a link. So that's something that we're asking for the VA to do. There's going to be a meeting between the CAP, the VA, and ATSDR in October, later, I think October 17th, I don't remember the exact date. But that's something that needs to happen. Because Camp Lejeune needs to have an illness registry so we can start getting accurate counts of who has what and who is, you know, where these people are and stuff.
So, Mike, when you say that's something that we're going to ask the VA to do, who are you directing these inquiries with? I mean, do you get to go right to Wilkie and say, hey, Wilkie, sit down, let's talk? Or is there a lot of... Go ahead.
There's always middle management involved. In the past, it was Dr. Ralph Erickson. I believe I heard at the meeting, I didn't get to confirm this, but I believe he's now retiring. Brad Floor was another member of that, of the VA. I forgot his exact title, but he was with VBA. He was also asked about this registry. And now Dr. Hastings, she is kind of taking up where Brad Floor left off. And you know, she is the one that's going to be participating in this meeting with the VA. But no, we can't necessarily, I mean, and that's what a lot of people, when you deal with this issue, they want to run to the president or run to, you know, Secretary Wilkie. You cannot do that. You just can't knock on the door and say, hey, you know, President Trump or Secretary Wilkie, this is a problem, you're going to fix it. You have to work your way up through the system. And you have to talk to people, present that to the staff, talk to the staff. Like the meeting I got with Secretary Wilkie, Jerry and I just didn't knock on the door and say, hey, we spent years building relationships with people within the VA and also in congressional offices that put us in a position to where when the issue became a problem, it was elevated to Secretary Wilkie. And I mean, that's another story, another probably another interview, another segment down the road. But you can't, you just, and a lot of people, and you see it in history where, hey, if we go tell the king or tell the czar of what's really going on, he's going to magically see it and make everything right. That's not how the process works.
So what can our listeners do to help your organization?
Well, you know, get online. We've got the Few, the Proud, the Forgotten. There's a lot of good information, especially if you're fighting for illnesses with Camp Lejeune. There's a timeline of events on there. There's information of what's going on. But, you know, the veteran is their biggest self-advocate. You've got to get involved, educate yourself, and fight things out. And then when you run into a roadblock, you know, time and time again, a veteran will come up to me like the one that did in Washington and say, hey, I've got kidney cancer. I got service connection, but they gave me 0%.
Hey, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have a caller. If Doug could bring that on, perhaps Mike can. Go ahead, Doug. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, welcome to the Veterans News Hour. Do you have a question for Mike?
Yes, I do. First of all, I would like to thank all three of you for taking the fight to the Marine Corps for us veterans that have no other recourse. You are certainly appreciated. But my question is, actually, the National Personnel Records Center seems to be throwing roadblocks as far as getting DD-214s for us veterans that were at Camp Lejeune. The last time I tried to get my DD-214 was ironically in 2012, and instead of sending me my DD-214 that showed where I was when, they sent me a certificate of military service that has my dates of service, where I was, or I mean when I was in, and it shows no information about where I was when. And I kind of have to believe that they've got our records flagged, and so I have no way to prove a claim because I can't show where I was.
Okay. If I could just say something real quick on that, and then have our guest talk about it. I would suggest when you put in a request to the archives, the National Personnel Records Center, that you make it clear that you want a copy of all your records, not just your DD-214. Because it's going to be in the other records, not your 214, which will show your list of assignments as well as many other things. Go ahead, Mike or Rick, go ahead.
Actually, I was going to jump in here because this is a common thing that we see on the websites and people asking. A couple things with that. Number one, when you do file a claim for Camp Lejeune for service, you know, for connection to your illnesses and everything, the VA does the record search and does the verifying. If they can't find your records, then they come back and say, we can't find it, you need to prove you're at Camp Lejeune. And that's where your military records would come in. The DD-214 itself is not going to specifically show that you're at Camp Lejeune or how long you were there. That's going to be in your service record or portfolio. What I did in my case, you know, my birth records were out of the Naval Hospital, and I could not find them. So I contacted my congressman's office and spoke with a staff member there, had them order my records from Camp Lejeune, and ironically my Navy records showed up out of the blue. I didn't even know they existed because I was only in there for about a little bit less than 90 days, just enough not to be VA qualified for anything. But And I say that because the base I was at was also contaminated, I found out later. But I got my Navy records out of the blue, and it was everything, all my doctor's records, everything that transpired in the Navy for 80-plus days. But contact your congressman, ask for assistance, ask them to order your service record. But if you're filing a claim with Camp Lejeune, the VA does that record verification to verify you were at Lejeune. And if they can't, then they have to come back to you and say that you're not there. And that's where you got to produce the proof on that. Is that your case there, or what's happened with the VA?
Well, I'm just now getting diagnosed. I started having seizures a couple of months ago, and I found a meningioma brain tumor. And they think I also have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Okay. Now, have you filed with the VA yet for Lejeune?
Not yet. The only reason why I haven't, because I felt like I needed a definitive diagnosis before I took that step.
Okay.
So,
I'll leave that to the lawyers, but that's out of my realm.
my advice to you there is I'd go ahead and file your claim. Get it in the system and start working it. Because it's going to take a long time, and in the meantime, you can start working on getting your definitive diagnosis. But it seems that you've at least got what we call a prima facie case to make the claim. So go ahead and make the claim, because it's going to take time. And in the meantime, you'll end up getting that medical evidence that you do need. So I would say file it.
Okay. All right. Good deal. I'll do that.
Good deal.
And the other thing, too, is if you file the claim now and say it takes a year for them to get through the process or what have you, it goes back to today's date rather than if you wait a year and file it when you get your official diagnosis.
Oh, okay. So I'm filing based on the symptoms. Is that pretty
well, yeah, idea? But you're doing that. But what Mike was saying there, and that's a very, very important point, is that now, if you file it with September of 2019, and you're on the books for 2019, and as you go through the system, you may get denied, but you'll always have that retroactive date to 2019. So when your case is successful, then you have to be compensated retroactively back to 2019, as opposed to waiting a year from now for your definitive diagnosis, as you called it. At that point, you've wasted about a year of retro payment.
Right.
So it's better to get it going now, get it filed, and move forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds like a winner. Thank you, guys. I appreciate you.
Yep. Thanks for
calling.
Thank
you. Thank you for your service.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's another good point that you brought up there, Mike, that all veterans that are listening. You know, if you're on the fence about whether or not to file, David, you can chime in here, but my advice would be, Get it filed. You're going to go through a denial process. You know, the VA, delay, deny, hope you die is their motto. So you're going to have a period of denials, and you keep filing your appeals so that your retroactive date is the date that you have to be compensated retroactively, and that could be a lot of money. You know, I've seen some handsome retro payments. David and I have given them out. For veterans. So get
we're
that
about
a,
out
think,
of time. Rick just wanted to mention we're about out of time if you want to.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much. I know we had changed our hour from 9 to 7, so we interrupted your dinner hour. But I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the Veterans News Hour with us tonight. You're always full of a lot of information. And the work you're doing with the water contamination Camp Lejeune issues is just terrific. And I know, you've got your day job.
Yeah.
And so all this work you're doing for Marines.
I'm having a late dinner.
And all this work that you're doing for our service people is just terrific. And, I want to thank you for everything you do. But you have
a good
night.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, that was very, very helpful, very informative.
Yep, it is. And, again, listeners can find out more from their website, The Few, The Proud, The Forgotten. We're about out of time for tonight, so thanks for everyone listening tonight, and thanks to our special guest, Mr. Mike Partain. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hoy Law Group, and our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time, bbsradio.com, Station 1. Until then, we hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.